Revenue's better?
Yeah, oh, I'm much longer.
House Committee on Revenue for May 4th, 2017 will come to order. Colleagues, let me announce first that House Bill 2770 is not ready for work today. We will repost when we have the next amendment. We will open a public hearing on House Bill 2745. Oh, and he's not here? Okay. And we have Representative Huffman. Do you want to? Okay, give us a little bit on this bill, and then we'll hear from the good representative.
It's not about drones. Okay, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2745. I should note, even off the start, is there's a dash two amendment. It came in somewhat recently, so I haven't had a chance to actually go through, and that's why it's not included in the staff measure summary, but that is up there and available on OLS for viewing.
Okay.
It's continuing to make changes to the underlying bill, so go ahead and describe that. It's not a gut and stuff amendment by any means. So House Bill 2745, the A version, it's related to intergovernmental entities, specifically ones that are created to operate, maintain, and repair and modernize transportation facilities, and that do also qualify for Federal Transit Administration funding through general obligation bonds. So what it does is it allows these intergovernmental entities to issue bonds and also assess and levy and collect ad valorem property taxes. One of the key differences for the intergovernmental entities as opposed to a transit district would be that it does allow the intergovernmental entities to split up, essentially split up where you think of a normal taxing district. You'd have to apply one taxing rate to the entire taxing district. The difference for the 2745 and the entities is that they could set different rates or assess different property taxes based upon different areas within the intergovernmental entity and to the specific services that are being provided in those areas. That's probably my real quick overview on this.
Very good. Representative Huffman.
Thank you, Chair Barnhart. Committee, I'm John Huffman, State Representative for House District 59. I brought House Bill 2745 forward on behalf of local governments in Central Oregon, and I wanted to testify today that, as staff mentioned, the flexibility amongst the various local governments that would participate in the transit bill. Because of that and the need for area transportation, every one of my local governments in House District 59 has requested that I ask for your support. They've sent letters, resolutions, phone calls, any number of things. Every local government, though, has said we support the bill. That's it.
Very good.
Thank you very much.
Go back to your other committee. Thank you so much. We very much appreciate it. Eric Kankler, Karen Friend, Wayne Fording, please. Thank you so much for traveling a long way to get to us today. We appreciate it. Whoever goes first, state your name and then give your testimony.
All right, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Eric Kankler, representing both the Central Oregon Intergovernmental Council and the City of Bend here in support of 2745A. And I should mention, in regards to the Dash A2 amendments, the discussion that we'll be having today references those amendments. We are still in conversations with Legislative Council about making tweaks to those amendments. So we're not issuing those for formal consideration, just to give you the underlying language that we're referencing when we talk.
You don't want us to move this tomorrow.
No.
Thank you.
Yeah.
I'm sorry. Bad joke. Please go ahead.
Unfortunately not. So we'll have two quick panels today. Myself, Karen Friend, the Executive Director of COIC, Wayne Fording, Vice Chair of COIC, and also Jefferson County Commissioner. And we will be followed up by George Endicott, Mayor of Redmond, Sally Russell with the Bend City Council, and Drew Hagedorn with the Oregon Transit Association. So most generally, House Bill 2745A represents a model for growing regional transit in a manner that's suited to and supported by each of the communities that it serves. It would do so by allowing those communities to fund transit needs with dedicated property tax revenue on their terms. And so this is a little bit unique in that regard, as staff mentioned a moment ago. So Central Oregon is what we're talking about here. consisting of Crook, Deschutes, and Jefferson counties. It's served by Cascades East Transit, which is operated by COIC. They provide service to all eight cities in the region, as well as Warm Springs and Mount Bachelor. And they also provide service within the region's larger cities, primarily through various local funding partnerships. Cascades East Transit has been highly successful. It's been broadly supported throughout the region. Frankly, that it's been so successful without a dedicated tax base is quite remarkable. But there are limits to the revenue that can go in that fashion, and so we're seeking opportunities to establish a dedicated tax base that fits each community. And the big question is, how do we continue to grow this successful transit operation in the future, again, in a way that works for each community? So this bill is designed to do that. It's premised on ensuring local control. Its property tax revenue for transit won't be raised unless the transit provider, in this case COIC, the affected local governments, and the voters all support that. For communities that want to grow transit operations via property tax revenue, this allows them to do it on their terms. For communities that don't want to grow it, nobody's going to force them to do otherwise. It really does embody local control to the fullest extent. So at the local level, the bill's been the result of significant local collaboration and process. It enjoys the support of all eight Central Oregon cities, the area's chambers of commerce, key institutions such as St. Charles Hospital, OSU Cascades, a number of other stakeholder groups, including transit advocates and riders, school districts, neighborhood associations, economic development entities, so on and so forth. The bill passed out of the House Committee on Transportation Policy 9-0 on March 22nd. The record thus far includes, I think, somewhere above 40 letters of support. Initially, we had a letter of neutrality from the Department of Revenue and the assessors on some technical issues, which are worked out to their satisfaction in the A engrossed version of the bill. So at this point, we have no known or formal opposition on the record to this bill. So who would this apply to? It, as drafted, and it's not explicit to COIC, but it does apply to ORS 190 intergovernmental entities that qualify for transit funding from the federal government. And Karen can talk to you more about that. That is only COIC at present. Others could aspire to pursue this in the future, but right now this is a bill that we're hoping to pass and have an opportunity to prove on the ground in Central Oregon before anybody really thinks about other areas. So what types of funding would this allow? As staff mentioned, there are basically three types, and there are different processes established under the bill to accomplish these. One, there would be general obligation bonds backed by property tax increases that could be used for capital improvements. COIC could already do this under current law, but there's really no structure in current statute, so this would give structure to that. It would also allow for local option levies for transit operations, either region-wide or in specific zones as determined by the local governments. And three, it would allow for permanent tax rates for transit operations, again, either region-wide or within zones. And really, it is the zones that we're intending to focus on, and that's the heart of this proposal. A little bit in the way of procedural details. The establishment of general obligation bonds and local option taxes, again, whether region-wide or by zone, would require COIC and affected jurisdictions to jointly agree to take a ballot measure to the voters. The voters, of course, then would have to approve it. So if the voters didn't support it, there'd be no tax. And if the local governments didn't support it, there'd be no ballot measure in the first place. It really does require institutional support from the top to the bottom. Bless you. The setting of permanent rates would be a little bit more involved. The first step in that process would be to, and this is by virtue of constitutional constraints and measures 5 and 50, we would have one opportunity basically to establish a tax limit before we could consider individual taxes, whether region-wide or within the zone. So we would have to establish a region-wide permanent rate limit that would require participation from and ultimately approval of all the affected local governments. It's a pretty high bar, quite frankly, but I think that's the only way it makes sense. The second step, if you want to do zones, would be to establish those zones. COIC would work in concert with its local governments, and this could be done either at the same time as you're setting a permanent rate, or it could be done later. So the local governments and COIC would agree if they ran through a whole bunch of steps that we've articulated in the bill, then they would have the ability to set a permanent rate at or less than the established rate cap and subject to a number of standards in the bill. So I'm going to talk a little bit about accountability, and then I'm going to hand it off to others. I think it's evident that there's some flexibility in this model. We've got three types of funding. We have different procedures. The bill is not meant to tie us into doing things a specific way, but it is meant to be accountable no matter how we use it. So, for example, in all cases, state statute would limit the revenue to the purposes stated in the bill, which for GO bonds is capital, and for permanent and temporary rates is transit operations. There could be no use of this funding outside of those realms. If money is raised within a zone, that money has to be spent in that zone. So you can't, you know, we don't want a situation where voters are approving their own tax increase and then the money goes somewhere else. So that would be in statute, and I'm sure it would be embodied in resolutions and working agreements at the local level. All the taxes would be subject to a number of accountability measures. There would be annual reporting. There would be a requirement to have a detailed transit plan, oversight by a local transit advisory committee, and a very publicly involved process, including passing these and discussing these, all of these measures in public meetings. Last point, the bill applies to non-rail transit only. Its contemplated use is for bus systems. It's not limited to bus systems. We don't know what the future holds. As technology innovates, the model could innovate along with it. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Yes, ma'am.
Good afternoon, Chair Barnhart and committee. Thank you for allowing me to come testify today. I'm the executive director for COIC.
And could you state your name for the record, please?
Sorry, Karen Friend.
Thank you, Karen.
Thank you. So I want to tell you a little bit about the work that was done that kind of led up to this effort. COIC is a regional entity in intergovernmental cooperation. We were formed in around 1971 through an intergovernmental cooperation with our cities in Central Oregon, as well as our three counties and the Warm Springs Tribe. That makes up our board. There's an elected official from each county commission, as well as an elected official from each city council and an appointee from the tribes. Our board also has five appointed members that represent chambers of commerce, higher education. So there's a private sector representation on our board. We do things that are done on a regional basis on behalf of our local governments. And so we've been, over the years, very responsive to the needs of our local governments and our local communities about the needs in our community. That's how we happened to become approached to begin transit for the Central Oregon region in 2007. In 2008, we launched this regional system called Cascades East Transit. It's been wildly successful. It's grown. It's, you know, continues to have an increase in ridership and continues to be a necessary infrastructure of the Tri-County community. So the work that as a result of creating the transit system and growing it, it's a locally funded system, voluntary contribution beyond the grants and federal funding that's received, and it is limited as its growth as a result of that. And so as our board began to plan for the future sustainability and stability of transit on behalf of the cities and counties, the desire became to talk about, you know, a long-term solution. And so looking, there was a committee formed back in 2013 of community leaders and our board that looked, you know, did a deep dive into what were the opportunities for stability and sustainability for the system. And out of that came the desire to amend ORS 190, which was then limited to transportation facilities, to also include transit operations. And this work came out of that initial concept. And as we've worked through these processes with all of our locals and cities and counties to make sure that it fully met the needs of the local control and the flexibility, you know, and all of the desired elements of this bill, we've worked very collaboratively and feel that this is a bill that's representative, at least in our area, of all city and county interests and fully allows the build out of a system as they desire it and doesn't build beyond what they want and grows with them. As you can tell from the letters of support, and as Eric mentioned, we've worked with our chambers and economic development interests and local organizations, and feel that this is the right community solution for Central Oregon. So I guess just in closing, it's one of the things I would tell you that in relation to our operations and the effect of our operations, we've been told by the Federal Transit Administration, Region 10, which covers Northern California, Oregon, and Washington, that we have the most service on the board on the road for the federal dollar that they have provided for us. So we feel like we've provided an efficient operation for our counties and cities, and I think impetus toward having a bill and securing the governance model for this is a testament to that. And I would close just by saying that, you know, we represent cities from 500 to 89,000, so we're representing quite a diversity of viewpoints in each community. But they are all linked economically and socially, and it's COAC's job to represent them all. And we really are excited about the features of this bill that allow the flexibility and local control. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Great. Well, good afternoon, Rep Barnhart and members of the committee. My name is Wayne Fording, Jefferson County Commissioner, and I'm the COIC Vice Chair this year. And I want to thank you for letting us come over and testify. But I thought I'd touch a little bit on my perspective as a county commissioner of how the COIC board works. For the first 6 years, I'm going on my ninth year as a county commissioner. The first 6 years, I would always hear Commissioner Hatfield come back and give us board updates on what COIC was doing. And
I interrupt you just for a second?
Sure.
That term COIC has been used several times. Someone may have defined it earlier, but I missed it. Would you tell us again what that stands
for? Yeah, COIC is a Central Oregon Intergovernmental Council.
Thank you.
And what that is that is our Central Oregon COG.
Great. And I thought that's what you were talking about.
Right.
And that would explain why, as a member of a different board, you're the vice chair of that board.
Cool.
Because the member boards send representatives to establish the COG board.
Correct.
Thank you.
Yes.
Please go ahead.
No, that's great. I'm glad we touched on that, because that is COIC is kind of a different name for a COG. You know, most of them are known as a COG, but that COIC is Jefferson, Crook, and Deschutes counties and all the cities within. So thank you. But when John would come back from his COIC meetings, my thought was, boy, I'm glad you're doing that, not me. So, you know, after he left the Board of Commissioners, I've been on the board of COIC for 3 years, and it's amazing to me all the different things they get into, from workforce development to economic development to transportation. You know, I mean, we're the only COG that deals with transportation, and it's real interesting. We work with all the cities and counties, and the COIC board does a great job at bringing things forward to us, you know, when whether it's increasing services in Bend or Warm Springs or wherever it might be. By the time it gets to the board level, it's been vetted by that local government and the communities involved, and then we make the decisions to move forward. I'd also like to say that the Jefferson County Board of Commissioners are in full support of this bill, and we've had the conversation amongst us that probably in our lifetimes we'll never see anything to go out for a vote in Jefferson County, being we're so small and rural, you know, with a population of 22,000 and spread out quite diversely. So, but it does give areas the opportunity to increase services, you know, if that's what they choose to do. One of the neat things that I've seen since I've been on the board was the Confederated Tribes kind of came to CET, which is the transportation arm of COIC, and wanted some more services down in Warm Springs. And so Karen and her staff, they worked with representatives from the tribe, said, what is it that you want? Okay, we'll put it together. This is how much it costs. And in And they got the services they wanted. You know, they got more bus service down there, and that connects to Madras, which connects to Redmond, which connects to Bend, and it's just a great system. The other local input that I got here just at our department head meeting yesterday was our veteran service officer. I was mentioning that I was coming over to testify, and he's just like, yes, we definitely need this to get our veterans down to Bend to see their doctors and get around. The other neat thing that I was impressed of is, it's been about 2 years, but Culver, which is probably 10, 12 miles from Madras, a lot of their kids come into Madras for the Kids Club, which is an after-school program, and CET is a big part of that. They get these kids back and forth, keep them off the street, and it works good. The other thing I wanted to touch on was my concerns with the one-size-fits-all aspect for transit, which, you know, may work for the city of Bend, but it doesn't work for Jefferson County, where this bill works for Lapine, it works for Jefferson County, it works for Madras, it works for Prineville. You know, as we grow and transit is more important to a community, they can pick and choose what they want and how much service they want. So that's a great thing, you know. Sitting on the board, I came in 3 years ago right when this all was starting, and it just baffled me at first, but it took me a while to get my hands around this aspect, and I think this is a great compromise for our region and our transportation system, you know. I think it's kind of an innovative way to let rural transportation systems grow. If we cut this system apart, I can see my constituents being cut off from the, you know, the hub of Central Oregon, which is Redmond and Bend. So this rural transit innovation is one way to look at it, and it fits the need of our area. So thank you.
Thank you very much. Questions for this panel? You were very thorough. There is one. Yes, the one of us who whose district may be affected by this plan. Representative Bueller, please.
Thank you, Chair Barnhart. Question in of you. So if an entity defaults on a bond, who is the ultimate, where does the ultimate liability lie?
Well, in relation to the finances of COIC, all of the member governments are responsible for the funding that COIC has. I'm not the expert on those bonds yet, but so I don't know if that would follow. But that's how the organization, the member governments are responsible for the organization.
Just a point of clarification. So if City A defaulted on the bonds, then that liability would be passed out, be allocated to the other cities that make up COIC?
I think there's one wrinkle to that, in that it wouldn't be the City A that would be doing, should that occur, it would be these funds will be administered by COIC as an entity. So one local government wouldn't necessarily on its own be making decisions and managing money in a way that would jeopardize it. It would be the whole organization with all of the member parties to the board would be making those decisions jointly.
You used to get back to me with that.
Yeah. Absolutely. You're not authorized to sell bonds unless you've got a levy to pay for them, are you?
That's what I understood. That's why, aren't they covered by the levy?
A bond levy, of course, is a contract with the bondholders and is enforceable by the bondholders against the properties that pay the that pay the property tax that support the bond levy, unless I could greatly misunderstand the way our system in Oregon works. The object, of course, is to make certain that Oregon's bond rating is protected, and the bond rating of municipalities and school districts, so that we can get decent interest rates. Kyle, do you have something to add to that?
Oh, no, Mr. Chair, I was just going to basically reiterate what you were saying. If you're talking about a bond that's being secured by the property taxes, then it's going to be the property within the area that the bond is being issued to that secures it. So the residential, the commercial, the industrial property is what would be securing that bond that's sold.
Right, and the enforcement mechanism would then be the normal property tax assessment and collection process.
Yes.
Representative Bueller?
Yeah, point of clarification, though. In either one of you answer, please. But it is possible, if I'm not mistaken, in Oregon for a city to go bankrupt in the state of Oregon. Is that correct?
Let's defer that question until we see the next set of amendments. But I think that's a great question to take back to LC and to the green eyeshade people in the state treasurer's office who make sure that we get these things right.
Yeah, Mr. Chair and Representative Bueller, I'll look into that thoroughly and make sure to offer a complete response.
Thank you. That would be very helpful. Representative Pence.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for this presentation. We, of course, as you know, are working on a transportation package that will contain, we hope, a transit element. I'm sure you've been following along on this. Does this how does this bill mesh with the possibility that may actually happen?
Mr. Chair, Representative Bence, Vice Chair Bence, that's a good question. And I don't know that there is a clear answer to that other than to say that the way that this model would work, it wouldn't be a mandated model, and nor would it come at the expense of other funding opportunities. So you wouldn't find a situation where if we applied this model, we couldn't consider other funding sources. For example, we have a lot of institutional support. At present, the city of Bend, for example, pays about 1.45 million a year into its from its general fund into this. And some of the local institutions, St. Charles and others, make contributions as well. The federal government provides grants as well, which we match. We don't leave anything on the table, by the way. And those funding opportunities could still be there. So should there be other funding mechanisms resulting from the transportation package, those could continue to be on the table as well. What this is offering us is a dedicated option that could be a means of going far above and beyond what we've been able to wrestle up so far. So it could work quite compatibly, and there's no reason that it wouldn't have to.
Follow up. Mm-hmm. Right, so the focus so far has been on a payroll tax, a 0.1%. And of course, the amount raised in your area would be focused back towards you, unless, of course, you have already funded your transit mechanism, which event will simply take your money and spend it further east. I'm joking.
I haven't seen the language then.
It represents Bence's district.
Yes, exactly. That's all that's out there, Mr. Chair.
Right.
I just was curious how the possibility of that permanent funding mechanism based on this payroll tax concept would affect what you're planning here. And what I'm hearing is it wouldn't. They would be mutually supportive as opposed to damaging each other. Is that a correct thought? Or
Mr. Chair, Vice Chair Bence, that would be my presumption. We've had some loose conversations that said without specific details for a package, it's of course a little bit difficult to know exactly what we're talking about, but I don't think we're under any assumption that one would preclude the other or that they couldn't work compatibly in some fashion. And should there be funding coming in from other sources, I think that what the impact would be on the political will of a local government or a body of voters to consider this based on what else is on the table. Thus far, there hasn't been sufficient funding on the table by other means, and so there's really a big impetus to consider things like that. Something else came out of the blue and you know, filled our wallets and made everything perfect. I think it would probably be pretty likely that the will to do something more, this or otherwise, may not be there.
Just Just to add, could I add on to something to that? And the other thing is that, especially in the city of Bend, we've heard that there is a desire to have two different kinds of funding sources. For example, it was suggested to us at one point to do a combination payroll property tax because it affects different taxpayers. And so that was seen as a good mechanism. And so I think that they can absolutely complement each other. The other thing is that I understand from the state transportation package that that's for additional service, that it can't supplant what's already. And currently, as Eric indicated, the city of Bend is paying out of their general fund, and that's the piece that, you know, they would desire another tool for.
Mr. Chair, please.
I was just going to say, I think the metaphor fill the wallet is an overstatement of how much you're going to end up with, but
yes.
It's still in the talking stage, but I think you'll be hearing more about it next week, and there will be hearings, which we hope to hear from you when we hold those.
We're very much looking forward to that. And if I could make one final point in light of the larger transportation conversation, it's very likely that if through this mechanism, Bend in particular is able to gain a stable, dedicated funding source for transit, that we would have more money freed up to fill our $80 million backlog on street maintenance and address a variety of other transportation needs with what we no longer need to use from the general fund. Now, that's hypothetical, of course, but it's been an active consideration and is probably a likely outcome.
Thank you very much. Other questions for this panel? Thank you so much. We much appreciate your testimony. George Endicott, Drew Hagedorn, and Sally Russell, please.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Chair Barnhart, Vice Chair Benson, and committee members. My name is George Endicott. I'm the mayor of Redmond, and I have actually a few slides here this afternoon to show you to put some of this in context. As you just heard, of course, I'm proud to say we're the hub of Central Oregon. Others might not agree with that, but if you look at the map, it's about, with the exception of Lapine, it's about 20 miles equidistant among all of the different cities. And, in fact, the major transit hub for the inner city portion of this system is in Redmond. And we're in the process now. We got a Connect Oregon 6 grant, and we're in the process of building a transit hub where all those buses from Prineville, Madras, Sisters and Ben come together, and then the folks go their disparate ways depending on where they're headed or coming from. So the map kind of shows where we are, but it also shows the need for folks to get around in Central Oregon. And as we know, most of the people using the transit system are those either seniors or those in need or trying to get to a doctor's appointment. And a lot of students use it, and also we know that, like I said, the seniors, some disabled, are using the system, but a lot of those that don't have the means to have a private vehicle to get around. One of the things I wanted to cover was why this new model. And, in fact, earlier this week I met with Representative Buehler, and he and I were talking a little bit about this system. And from that derived a look at this matrix that we developed here. And why are we doing this? Well, as you already heard, the COG exists, and we call it COIC, as you know. And so we would not have to create a new layer of bureaucracy or government for Central Oregon. You know, by law right now, we could create a transit district. They're all over the state. But our choice, given that you passed this law, that we would use an existing governance model called COIC, and it would not create a new level of bureaucracy or government in Central Oregon. Secondly, as you heard already, under the current law, all districts or all participants in that system have to pay the same rate. As you heard, you know, first, does a jurisdiction even want to participate? If they do want to participate, at what level do they want to participate? And then if they answer to both of those when they've come up with those, then how much do they want to pay to get that level of service? And it will be different for the different jurisdictions participating in our transit district. It creates an independent voting authority separate from city lenders, and as you know, city leaders, sorry. And as you know, under a transit district, it is a separate body that exists. In this case, it's a body that already exists, made up of our local government officials. And so to us, it's sort of a double whammy in that our own local governments are responsible to COIC, which in turn then the transit district would be responsible for. So it gives the elected officials that exist already the authority to manage CET and not an independent body. One of the next points then requires city and citizens participate for all recommendations, and in our case, yes. And as you probably know, many of you, I'm not going to badmouth other transit districts that exist in the state, but you know that one of the biggest complaints in many of those is that the local citizens or the local governments have very little say in what happens in those transit districts. And so to accompany that, then, the oversight by the elected officials, in our model, there would be that oversight, and in other existing models, it does not happen. The citizens then, as I pointed out a few minutes ago, get to decide whether or not they even want to participate in this. Not all do. There might be one of the smaller cities that has a few citizens, and they just can't afford to participate, or they have some other means that they'd like to pursue. And then finally, you know, our position, of course, is that it is best for citizen participation because if it comes up, then the citizens would actually get to vote on whether or not they want to do this. So the bottom line, and the last piece I'll say here, the region does need an effective and efficient transit system for all of the different types of groups that exist in Central Oregon. It should not, and in our case probably will not, be one size fits all, and you'll hear in a minute, I think, why that's the case. We each need a voice in the system and in the decision-making process, and we will have that. And so my final point, I'll actually read it. This is a common-sense governance model that utilizes an existing organization rather than creating a new bureaucracy. So thank you very much for your time.
Mayor. Please.
Greetings. I'm Sally Russell. I'm the mayor pro tem. Thank you, Chair Barnhart, and the committee for listening to this House bill today. I'm here standing in for Mayor Casey Rhodes, who had some business, unexpected business today, so he could not be here. I'm standing in for the Bend City Council, and I want to tell you that although our council usually or pretty much never votes unanimously, this is one issue that we can as a group all agree on, and so that's always a moment to celebrate. and I think because we see the way that a transit system and a really functional transportation system can serve our city, and also as COIC is structured, the way our city interfaces with the rest of our region. We have many people who live outside of Bend and come inside to Bend to work, and we actually have the opposite as well. So we have lots of people moving in and out of Bend. We have for different services and for employment. So we have OSU Cascades, we have Central Oregon Community College, we have St. Charles Medical Center, and we have the county, just to name a few. So again, not only as the fastest growing city do we really need to find better ways to move our citizens through around our community in our 100-year-old roads, which are narrow and have restricted right of way, we also need to be able to understand how we serve the greater community outside. Not to mention we have a large tourist population that drops in on our beautiful town every summer. And so part of having an effective transit system also means that as we move people around more efficiently, it also meets our values of clean air and a culture that really values this incredibly beautiful natural environment that we live and work and play in. So let's see. I thought I'd tell you just a little story about my point of view. I've actually worked on transit a lot over the past 8 to 10 years and transportation in the whole. I have two daughters. I've always been a working mom. It's been really tough at times to really move them from school to their various activities. And a transit system would have been our choice, but with headways at 45 minutes, I have to find some way to move my children to their various places without them depending on me or my neighbors or, you know, and so again, not only is it the families that need to move themselves back and forth for their daily activities, but I also worked on an area, we were looking at transit, I think it's now 4 or 5 years ago, when we looked at specific areas that actually the buses were full all the time, and we worked to beef up those systems in those areas. Those were particular areas that had elderly people, low income, were moving back and forth to medical services all the time, and they really, really needed a system that they could count on so they could get to their appointments on time and be well served. And so all of those reasons are good reasons why our council unanimously supports this.
Thank you very much. Drew.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, committee members. I'm Drew Hagedorn, appearing today on behalf of the Oregon Transit Association, testifying in support of House Bill 2745. The Oregon Transit Association considered this, and its board unanimously voted to support the act. I think they did so because they believe that this is a vital tool for local governments to be able to utilize to identify some additional sources of revenue to finance transit needs in communities. Mr. Vice Chair, you mentioned earlier the Joint Committee. The work group on transit focused on a number of objectives for the revenue that would be derived from that package, and foremost among them was ensuring that we were connecting communities and that we weren't having redundant agencies, that we were finding economies of scale throughout communities. I think this bill is a beautiful illustration of just that. Furthermore, obviously this contemplates a local revenue stream, and of course what we're talking about in the package is more a state revenue stream that would benefit local communities. We often talk in the building about everyone having skin in the game, and I think this is another opportunity for this community to have some skin in the game to match the investment that the state would make. So we're excited about this. We hope it can be replicated at some point in other communities that would see fit to move forward with a proposal like this. And, of course, if the broader package the Joint Committee is working on moves forward, we'll look for more opportunities to find these types of economies, scales, and linking communities. So thank you very much for your consideration and appreciate the time today.
Thank you. Questions for this panel? Thank you all very much.
Chair.
Representative Bueller, please.
Thank you, Chair. Just a question about legal organizational structure. What's the legal structure?
For the Council of Governments?
It is the Council of Governments.
Yes, it is. Yeah, it is the existing Council of Governments called Central Oregon Intergovernmental Council.
Legal structure? Is it a 501c3? What's its legal?
It's a government entity.
Yeah.
Established by statute, made up of members of the boards of the government organizations that are members, elected by those government boards.
So, a follow-up question.
And I assume you have school districts on your board as well, do you, or not?
I don't know.
Mr. Chair, if I may try to field the question,
please.
Those behind me may have a better answer. Yeah. Drew Hagedorn again. Transit districts are formulated under a variety of statutory authorizations under the Oregon Revised Statute. And if I recall correctly, this one was formed under ORS Chapter 190.
But it's not clear, I just read that, and it's not clear what that means. It's not in the statute. It doesn't really.
Al, can you explain it to us? My assumption from the testimony has been that this establishes the COG as the government, as the board of this organization. If that's wrong, I'd like to know that.
Mr. Chair, I can't say much about it. It does add it to the list of the statute that's already in place, the ORS 190. There's the listing of a number of different intergovernmental entities, and this would be adding an additional component to that statute.
COAC is legally formed under ORS 190. It is considered a political subdivision. It is considered local government.
Okay. Representative Bence points out, on page 2, lines 25, section 2 of the bill, that's precisely what the bill does, is it sets them up with the authority to run this organization. Representative Bueller.
So just to follow up on that, so then employees of COIC are public employees?
That is correct. They are public employees.
Yep.
Yeah. Other questions? Thank you. Very much appreciate your testimony. Marcia, may we consider your written testimony as your testimony today?
Actually, I'd just like to say one little bit besides my written testimony.
Please come forward.
Chair Barnhart, members of the committee, Marcia Kelly, the Oregon Women's Rights Coalition, and in addition to my written testimony, which points out the number of seniors, I have sort of a connection to this bill in that I was born in Bend. I spent part of my formative years in Bend, and in a single-parent household, I took the bus to my dancing lessons. We lived close enough to walk to school, but I had to take the bus to my dancing lessons, and that was, I hate to say this, in 1956, Bend was about 10,000 people. My mother also depended on the bus to get to her job as the bookkeeper at Meadowland Dairy. And my half-sister used the bus to do after-school activities as well. Transit can really provide a lot of vital things, and I would really like to see a more robust transportation system in my hometown and my dad's hometown.
Thank you very much. Questions for Marcia? Thank you. We appreciate your testimony. With that, we'll close the public hearing. Let me just say we look forward to the next amendment. And I'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2745 and open a work session on House Bill 2067. Paul, tell us what we're doing. We will take a short recess. Please don't go away. When we left, we were under the work session on House Bill 2067. Colleagues, what we have, actually, I let Paul explain it. We're talking about the Dash 3, Paul.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, we've had a hearing on House Bill 2067 in its introduced form, but it was largely a placeholder and had Guatemala removed from the list, and that was just basically as a procedural matter to have some substance to the bill. So what the Dash 3 does, it adds Guatemala back to the original list as it was, and it's consistent with the recommendations that came from the Department of Revenue, and it adds eight different jurisdictions. These jurisdictions that are added are a combination. First of all, Panama, which was on the original Montana list, was taken off by the 13 legislature, but is recommended based on the MTC criteria Department of Revenue uses. It is added back on. There's also an addition of several other jurisdictions that were recommended in the 2015 DOR report. Those include Hong Kong, the Netherlands, and Switzerland. And so those are added to the list. And then there were some additional ones from the 17 DOR report. That's Jordan, Lebanon, Macau, and the United Arab Emirates. There was also a recommendation to include Ireland, but that is not in the Dash 3. In terms of the impact that we would anticipate, I have a revenue impact statement for you, but first let me refer you to some of the background data that we have, which is from, it's called net income by jurisdiction. I'll just give you an idea of kind of how we're trying to determine what the revenue impact will be. This is data that comes from the U.S. Bureau of Economic Analysis. It's a report of U.S. affiliates and their net income and sales, and they have some employment data too, by country. So it lists all the countries, but a number of them, it doesn't have complete data set because of disclosure requirements. So what I've listed here is the first block jurisdictions there are ones that we have data on that are in the current list. And you can see that Luxembourg, which has net income reported there by U.S. affiliates of $131 billion. So those are in millions. And you can see down the list there, Luxembourg being the largest. And the two that show up there as the largest in net income by U.S. affiliates. We're also the two countries that we received the most revenue from in our first year of implementing the policy in 2014 corporate tax year. There is some rough match there. It wouldn't necessarily be that way, but it does work out that way in terms of the first year. And you can see as you go down that list, they get smaller and smaller. And then if you get below that, you have most of these. You can see Malta, for example, under sales as a D. Well, that means they can't reveal that for disclosure law. And that's what happens to the ones that aren't on the list. Mr. Chair, I think you have a question.
Oh, yes, Representative Smith.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a 101 question here. Paul, so on Luxembourg and I guess in this case the Netherlands, based on the net income that you're showing us there, what did that result in for the state of Oregon?
You have another table for that, don't you?
We have another table?
I have a revenue impact that's based on that. The sum of all of the current jurisdictions for 2014 tax year, and remember we issued a report and talked about this, is about $28 million.
Okay.
So, and Luxembourg itself is a little over $12
million. Wow. Okay.
So what I did was went through that, used those revenue numbers, and went through the income numbers I had and constructed a very crude effective tax rate. And so that's how we've derived revenue estimates for these additional countries that would be on the list. The Netherlands, Hong Kong, Switzerland, and Panama are the four that I do have income data for. And so that's really the basis of our revenue estimate. So it's still pretty indirect. We have 1 year of department corporate income data that we can work from, which is a lot better than we were a couple of years ago. So we have that, and then we try to tie it back through this indirect data source, which is this Bureau of Economic Analysis macro level data. So there we would expect a correlation, though it's probably not going to be real tight in individual cases, but it does give us a basis. And so when you look at that data and work back with using this, the idea of an effective tax rate, which comes out to be a pretty minuscule number because it's a very large net income number and you're apportioning it back to Oregon. Remember, this all runs through the apportionment formula. So you're adding this income back that's reported in this jurisdiction, and then you're multiplying that times the apportionment formula of Oregon sales versus Water's Edge sales. And if there are sales in this listed jurisdiction, those are also factored in for the apportionment. These, if you look on the OLIS, you can see our revenue impact estimates. We would anticipate that it's effective with the 2018 corporate tax year. So we would have 1 year of revenue coming in for the 17-19 biennium. We're estimating that at about $20.7 million. And then you can see our projections basically double as we have two full years to collect in those out years for the biennium. What we've seen in terms of the first year of collections relative to what we thought, they came in slightly over about $28 million, and then we were expecting around $20 million. So that suggests the current law estimates are also higher than what we've been assuming before. But those should be built into the revenue forecast that comes out in May.
Thank you. Other questions? Representative Johnson, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Paul, refresh our memory, if you could. How many other states would currently have a list of tax havens of countries of this magnitude?
This is based on the specific list of jurisdictions that Montana has, and Montana's list goes back to 2003. We have a number of other states, Connecticut, for example, West Virginia, that have a requirement under certain criteria that income be reported back to the state and included, but it doesn't have a specific list of countries.
Do you have some, Johnson?
So I guess the question would be, other states are not drawn to this potential revenue stream for whatever reason, and a couple of states are. And I guess the question we would have to make is this in our best interest to single out these countries for this sort of designation or not? But I guess the other question I would have more specifically, as I recall, we had the conversation around Netherlands back in the 2015 session,
and at that point in time, we elected not to list them. My question would be, what's changed with their tax policy since that time that would motivate us to want to put them on the list of tax havens at this point in time?
Okay. Representative Pence?
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Is there an answer to that?
Oh, I thought that was rhetorical.
Oh, that's
a question.
Okay. Specifically, yeah.
What's changed?
What's changed, I guess, regarding Netherlands? Why we would choose?
Yeah, I think the assumption behind the question is that we need to have a change in their policy in order to change ours. I reject that assumption.
So it's chair's discretion, then, I guess, is what you're saying.
Well, no. I think it's up to the committee to determine which countries are listed.
We haven't
gotten to that, so we'll see. Representative Vance?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I think, Paul, I'm looking at Roche's letter of May. Genentech's member of Roche, if I'm saying that right, dated May 1st, and in one of the items in the materials. And they state, we completely agree with the intent of the policy, and I'm sure all of us on this dais join in that intent, to pursue corporate tax evasion. And they say, however, we believe it is simply more balanced and comprehensive to apply a set of criteria. And then they walk through the criteria. But, Paul, I need to have you refresh my memory as to why we have chosen the country approach as opposed to the criteria approach suggested in their letter.
I think there's a couple of aspects to that, Mr. Vice Chair. One is we did have, at the time the decision was made in 2013, we did have a model of a state that was using this approach in Montana, and did have discussions with them, and they the advantage, I think, of the listing of the jurisdictions is it is a very clear requirement that if you have an affiliate that's in one of these listed jurisdictions, you have to report that income. So that puts the Department of Revenue in a position where they have the information, it's on the return that's required to be reported. Now, the other issue that you modified and with Senate Bill 61 in 2015 and have had further discussions about is to give the department the flexibility for those situations when they feel that inclusion of this income distorts that company's or that corporate filing group's economic activity in Oregon. And remember that we're still, the basic premise is we're starting from the water's edge, which has been the Oregon law since the mid-80s. You're starting from that, and the income that's in these listed jurisdictions is augmenting that water's edge. So you're adding that income to the water's edge and then reporting that on the return and then giving the department some discretion about whether this meets the intention that this income really is identified or affiliated with U.S. activities. And that's the theory behind it.
In a follow-up, if I may. Yeah. They capitalize the word every in the next sentence. They say, mm-hmm. Genentech has supported HB 2672, which would strike the use of the tax haven blacklist, and instead give Oregon a clear set of criteria for the Department of Revenue to identify and capture illicit investments, and then they say, from every country in the world. The suggestion appears to be, or implication is, that we're missing something by virtue of the mm-hmm. approach that's suggested by the bill before us. Am I misreading their letter? Not understanding their letter?
Mr. Vice Chair, I think what they're saying is that if there's a way to identify explicit profit-shifting activities that are where income is misreported or should be reported in another jurisdiction where it's more closely identified with the economic activity, then it should be universal and should be worldwide. But I think the approach here with the listed jurisdictions is something that is very direct, is simple. And administratively, it puts the department in a position where they're receiving this information rather than going out and searching for
right.
it. And that's probably the biggest difference in terms of the compliance of them. And as you recall, when we went through our report that you required us to do, we talked about some of the benefits and costs of this approach. Certainly the benefit is the simplicity and the information the Department of Revenue gets. The cost is that it is a blunt tool, that you are requiring what could well be legitimate activity in a particular jurisdiction, and you're identifying these jurisdictions based on these criteria, that it is a blunt tool, and you may end up in situations where that the income really is truly not reflective of U.S. activities. The idea was behind Senate Bill 61 was to give the department some flexibility to manage that. If you feel that's not strong enough, or if there's instances where they're not exercising that, then that would be something we could come back and visit in a policy sense. And we're looking at, continue to look at ways to see how this is being administered.
Let me comment on both of those questions. We've spent a good deal of time in the last bill talking about these, both of these issues. On the first issue, those who engage in accounting transactions that are simply for the purpose of evading taxes are responsible for reporting that income to the state of Oregon, and I think actually to the Internal Revenue Service as well. They just don't do it. And the fact that this mechanism actually produces income, compliance income, actually demonstrates that they just don't do it. So the argument that the company makes that every country, that it involved investments in every country in the world, is a correct statement. The problem is that businesses simply don't report it. When they're required to report their activities in certain countries, then the Department of Revenue has the information in the tax return from which they can determine that portion of it that should be reported or accounted for in Oregon. And of course, they have the benefit of the company's own analysis of what part of it should be reported in Oregon, because that's the part that the company has already reported and paid taxes on. When you look at the issue of that issue, it came up last time in the discussion with Hewlett-Packard and their concern that income that was actually being generated in other parts of the world would be counted as income in Oregon. We added the clarification that the department had the ongoing authority to separate out that income from the income that ought to be considered U.S. income, and therefore apportioned partly to Oregon. Hewlett-Packard hasn't been back to ask for any changes. Based on a lack of them coming back, the suggestion to me, at least, is that that particular aspect of the department's work is working. They have the capacity, once they have the information in hand, to make the determination as to what part of that income should be reportable in Oregon as Oregon income, and therefore taxed in Oregon, and what part of it should be taxed in Brazil or China or somewhere else. I think we worked that out, and nobody has come forward on that basis. Let me make a couple of additional comments as long as I'm still talking here. When you look at Luxembourg, at the top line of this affiliates, they report sales of $71 billion, for U.S. affiliates, and net income of $131 billion. It's quite obvious that a substantial number of dollars are being treated as income in Luxembourg that do not reflect Luxembourg sales. And indeed, Luxembourg is the largest contributor, not the country, but the companies that use these transactions in Luxembourg to our revenue in this context. Similarly, the Netherlands is even larger in terms of its net income, although the sales are also larger. The fact is it boggles the mind to think that American companies are doing so well in the Netherlands that well more than half of their sales in the Netherlands drops all the way to income. All the way to net income. Some of that net income should be reported in the United States and in Oregon as income in the United States and in Oregon, and the taxes should be paid on it. The revenue estimate reflects that. This is simply a way of a compliance mechanism to require that companies that use these mechanisms, even if they manage to avoid the Internal Revenue Service's need for revenue, should not be able to evade Oregon's need for revenue. Representative Bueller, please.
Yeah. Thank you, Chair Barnhart. So I completely agree with the intention of this policy to try to, you know, bring in bad actors that are using international sanctuaries for tax havens. What I'm still confused on is the criteria that is being used to put countries on the list or remove them. Mm.
I'd refer you to the two reports that we've received at the hearing, at which those are very clearly and extensively described. Other discussion? Representative Smith Warner, the dash three, please.
Mr. Chair, I move committee accept the dash three amendment to House Bill, go to the top here, to House Bill 2067.
Thank you. Representative Smith Warner moves the dash three amendments to House Bill 2067. Further discussion? Objections to the motion? With no objection, the motion is adopted. Representative Smith Warner, the bill, please.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2067 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Thank you. Representative Smith Warner moves House Bill 2067 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion? I think we'll call a roll.
Representative Bueller?
No.
Representative Hernandez?
Aye.
Representative Johnson?
No.
Representative Marsh?
Aye.
Representative Nose?
Yes.
Representative Smith?
No.
Vice Chair Smith Warner?
Aye.
Vice Chair Benz?
No.
Chair Barnhart?
Aye. Motion passes, and the bill goes to the floor with a due pass recommendation. I will carry, and we'll close the work session on House Bill 2067. Thank you, colleagues. Appreciate it. You have a half an hour with which to do something else. We will see you on Monday. Remember that we will also meet with the Joint Committee on Tuesday morning. With that, the committee is adjourned. Thank you.